Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of MPMA's Bug Bites. I'm one of your hosts for the show, Mike Bentley, and I'm joined with my co-hosts,
Ellie Lane
and
Laura Rosenwald.
Awesome. And today we are very excited to be joined by a very special guest, King Jones, who is the owner of CT Pest Solutions out of Connecticut. King, thanks for being with us today, buddy.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you guys for having me, and I'm looking forward to crowning the new king or queen.
I love it. Now, I'm going to assume that wasn't a Freudian slip, that he did start with king first. So I'm going to take that as a good omen. Laura and Ellie, you guys can read into that however you wish, but just saying, don't let that shake you, because he may already have an expectation for the game. So, King, I'll get you that $100.
That's
later,
a high honor. A high honor to uphold.
Laura, I'll take them where I can get them. They're few and far between at this point. Well, King, thanks so much for joining us, man. I really appreciate it. You know, it's every time we get a really fun guest, I always think, how did we trick them into doing this? And you know, most folks say that they haven't had a chance to listen to the podcast yet. I feel like we're at a disadvantage this time, though, because you said you've actually listened to an episode or two before, huh?
Yes, I have. I did listen to a few episodes, and they're interesting. They're great. I mean, every guest is a little bit different, and, you know, the questions are a little, you know, unique, and the stories are unique. But it sounds like you guys have a great time. So you didn't have to trick me much into getting into this. I just wanted to join the party and, you know, be a part of it. So it's an honor to be here.
No, man. Well, we're glad to have you. And it's only a party because you're here, buddy. And I think, King, in a different lifetime, you could be a politician, because I love how well you said that. It's interesting. And then a good recovery from there. That should be our tagline for the show. It's .. interesting.
Interesting.
Well, man, I know we've had all of our marketing.
Yeah.
We'll call up the marketing team again.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They'll love us for that. Oh, man. Well, look, King, I know we get a chance to hang out with you a lot, buddy, but share with our audience a little bit about who you are and where you're from, and maybe a little bit about how you got in the pest control industry, because I think your story is pretty interesting.
Sure. So I started in the pest control industry this July of 2024 will be 24 years.
Wow.
So I know I don't look a day past 30, but 24
really
years. Yeah, I'll be coming up on 24 years. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, it's gone by quick. You know, I started as a service technician for Terminix. And I worked at Terminix for 14 years. I was also a compliance administrator at Terminix for a couple of years as well. In about 2014, I decided to start my own business and ventured off into the journey of entrepreneurship. And 2 years into the business, I became a member of the Connecticut Pest Control Association board. And, you know, that's been great. I mean, it's been good, a big eye opener. And I will say, I think I was a little naive, even being in the industry for 16 years at that point. It was like a whole new world opened up to me. So sat on a board for the Connecticut Pest Control Association, and I am currently still on the board as the president. I held the membership committee chair, currently the president, like I said, and also the education committee chair. 2021 was accepted to the executive leadership program. So I'm the part of the 2021 ELP class. And again, a whole nother world opened up to me. You know, I was introduced into Mike and the beauty and
We'll cut it out. Don't worry.
You started to say something about being beautiful. Keep going, buddy. This is
I was open up to the beautiful world of MPMA. It's been wonderful. So, it's been great. It's been great. I mean, it's amazing that I've been in the industry for so long, and I, you know, became part of ELP, and it was just like, wow, I feel like I don't know anything, you know. So I learned a lot, you know, met a lot of great people, and, you know, fell back in love with the industry. And, you know, right now I'm a NPMA board member. I've sat on several different committees for the NPMA. And, you know, like I said, CEO of CT Pest Solutions. We've been in business. Actually, we're coming up on our 10-year anniversary. We're located in Naugatuck, Connecticut. And, you know, it's great. I mean, it's great to see the evolution of pest control. I'll tell you, you know, I started in 2000. So we had pagers, payphones, and maps.
Did you guys ever have the Nextel Direct Connects?
Yes, we did.
Oh, man, that was great. I love that. That was a great way to find your phone when you lost it, too. The amount of times I've dropped a Nextel Direct Connect in an attic and, like, blown in insulation and, all right, call my CSR from the home phone in the house. All right, good. Hit the button again. Hit the button again.
Yeah, yeah. But those things were indestructible.
Yeah. Oh, they were great. Yeah, the blue and black – or the yellow and black ones that have, like, the construction-grade aluminum and rubber on the outside. You could chuck those things out a window. Those are great.
It was
good for pest control. You could slam it right on a bug and kill it.
Yeah, leave it on your truck. You take off. You go. You turn back around. It's still there. Still works. You know, you're good to go. You know, so
I would venture to say, King, that neither Laura or Ellie have ever seen a Nextel Direct Connect device or even know what we're talking about.
Okay, I feel like I'm about to out myself. Were they the ones that had the? Yes. Okay, that's what I was about to ask.
The walkie-talkie, phones, yeah.
Like the glorified walkie-talkie. I do remember those. Yeah.
Yes.
I think that was before my time.
It was a lot of fun, you know, and it was really interesting when, you know, I would be at a customer's home and someone would, you know, two-way you and they say, "Hey, King, you know, what are you doing?" You know, and you're like, "Hey, I'm with a customer right now. Can you give me a call?" You know.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, man, that was.
Those are fun.
It did introduce some unique customer service challenges, some professionalism hurdles, so to speak. Especially when you're out, it's the end of the day on a Thursday or a Friday, and maybe somebody else is trying to get a hold of you to see what you're doing later. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. Oh, gosh. That's fun. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, it's really impressive to hear, I mean, just how involved you've been, and particularly after, you know, the length of time you had in the industry. And I think a lot of folks, I mean, may have been in the industry for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years and, yeah, think through, like, you know, how do I get involved with a state level board or get involved with NPMA? I mean, what was your catalyst to getting involved with the Connecticut board? And if somebody was looking to get involved with their state association, what would be a tip that you could provide them on how to do that?
Well, you know, for me, I'll say that, you know, when I started the business, the reason why I started the business, and that led me into getting involved with the Connecticut Pest Control Association more. One of my mentors, Emilio Pulse, suggested that I become a board member. And initially I'm like, yeah, why do I want to do that? What do you guys do? You know, I mean, I thought I was a member, you know. He's like, yeah, well, you're a member, but you know, you should be a board member, you know? So, I said, you know what, I'll check it out. I went to a board meeting and it did open my eyes. You know, like I said, I felt a little naive to the fact that I was in the industry for 14 years, but yet I didn't know what our local association did. And I started the business, you know, to help spread the word of how great this industry is. And it was another way to be able to do that and to get involved and help other individuals who are in the industry and who might have been stuck in that bubble and not know what else they can do to, you know, to take care of an industry that has taken care of them for so long and that they learned to love, you know? So once I started getting involved in that, and just attending the meetings, I'll be honest. I sat at every meeting every month for an hour. And it took me about a year to get my finger on the pulse of exactly what we were doing and how to do it. But the point is I showed up and I learned a lot for a whole year. And then the following years when I started to become more involved and more active in it. And it's just a very good sense of gratitude and appreciation from our peers and individuals in the industry for the work that we do. And I gotta say that's the best part of it is being able to do this. And it's I mean, it's great, you know, and the executive leadership program has been a really good program for me as well. And I've never seen myself in this. I never seen myself in this chair as a CEO, as an NPMA board member, as a CTCPA president. But I am, and I'm here to tell all those technicians, salesmen, or whatever other position you may have, or you may think you may not be able to do, that it's achievable. You can do it. You know, the only restriction is yourself. You know, you got to believe in yourself. And if you want to get involved in the industry, there are different avenues that you can go to. You can go to your local association, and I can guarantee you that they will welcome you with open arms to get involved and get engaged.
Yeah, that's perfectly said. And, you know, so often I'll hear people say, well, I don't really know how to get involved. And I mean, exactly what you said, just go talk to somebody. I mean, I think people will be pleasantly surprised at how excited every single board of every single association across the country would be to have somebody walk up and say, hey, I've got some years of experience or no experience in the industry, but I want to get involved in the board. How do I do that? And I would be shocked if they didn't offer you a path to do that. You know, you had Emilio, who's, you know, got a great history with the Connecticut board, but I mean, I think there's an Emilio out there for everybody, you know. Mm-hmm. And it really just starts with just going up there and asking somebody. And if you don't know who to ask, you can reach out to one of us, and we'd be happy to put you in touch with your state's leadership for sure. Well, and then when you're not busy with all this stuff, I mean, you stay a little bit busy at home too, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I have four girls. So yeah, I have four girls. Yeah, they keep us busy. Me and my wife busy. So my oldest is 23. She just graduated from UConn. Nice. And I have a 15-year-old, I had an 11-year-old, and I have a 6-year-old. The only male in the house is me and my dog, Max. He's a beagle. So, yeah, and all our kids are busy as well. I mean, you know, they're involved in, well, one was involved in gymnastics for about 6 years, traveling team. So, yes, every weekend, if anyone's been involved in any type of traveling team, you know what that's about. Pretty busy weekends. I have another one who is competition dance. She does the competition dance. So kind of all over the place with that, traveling. So, yeah, we stay pretty busy. So I enjoy it. I like to say that's what keeps me young.
Well, and for anybody that can't, that's not able to see this right now, because this is only an audio podcast, we don't have a video component to this, but all of us, we're on Zoom right now. And for anyone that has not had the pleasure of meeting King, he looks like he's about 20, 21 years old, baby. I have no idea how he does it. It's crazy, man. So whatever your skincare secrets are, like whatever this whole like never age thing is, whatever the secrets, man, you let me know after the show. I'll pay you good money for that. Cause as we can tell, as we can see, I'm aging like an old catcher's mitt. So
I think that's just called living in Florida for a number of years.
Yeah. This is Florida man's skin. That's what we got going on right now. And it only gets worse.
Oh man. Well, you're on the right track, you know, like, so just last week, my wife says, oh man, you have a lot of gray hair. I said, don't worry about that, honey. I have a haircut tomorrow. She says,
well, that's the secret is keeping it cut close. But unfortunately, I don't really have to worry about the top part because it just doesn't grow in most of the places. But the beard now, the beard is so gray on the sides. And if I let it get any longer than it is now, that definitely the gray starts to show. And then I start getting made fun of. So got to keep it
start
pretty
to
short.
Get to make fun of.
That's true. It's just one of many things. It's easy. They're just softballs right over the plate when it comes to making fun of me. I mean, it's fine. I'm easy game. So if you want to aim low, that's fine. That's fine.
Sorry, I mostly use this podcast to bully you.
That's what it usually is. So I have a really solid hard cry session usually at the last 30 minutes of the podcast after we stop recording. So. Oh man. Well, I'm not sure I could take any more of this, so we should probably go ahead and get the game started.
Do you want to move on, Mike?
Yeah, it's probably for the better. I can only record so many losses in a day.
All right. Well, sounds like you're an old pro at this, King, in many ways. So I won't take too long to describe what this all is about. But so we're each going to have 5 minutes to tell you about the coolest thing that we found this month in bug science or rodentology, depending on what we decide to pick. And so once we'll have our 5 minutes, you'll be able to ask us questions about what we just talked about. And then at the end of this all, you'll pick the winner. So, and like Mike described earlier, please just only pick the winner and do not tell the other two which one is last, because we're delicate and we have delicate feelings. So
I understand. Not a problem.
Awesome. The pride associated with winning this competition, the office is pretty big. So
it is. Awesome. Okay, and then I actually am the one who's going to get us started, so I will go ahead and go first. So the time will begin once I stop reading the title, because some of these titles can be real long for some of these scientific articles, so we try to give ourselves a little bit of grace on that front. But my paper this week, or month rather, is coming out of Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, Canada, so our lovely neighbors to the north here. And it's by Gooding et al. 2024. So this actually just came out this year, I think in late January, if I remember right. But so the title of my paper today is Black-Legged Ticks, Ixodes scapularis, Reduce Predation Risk by Eavesdropping on Communication Signals of Formica aureus Thatching Ants. When we think about ticks, we mostly concentrate on their ability to vector disease. This is especially true of Ixodes scapularis, or the black-legged tick, or the deer tick, which is responsible for transmitting up to 16 different diseases, of which the most notable is Lyme disease. However, what we often don't consider is the way that ticks interact with their fellow arthropods. This is something that we likely should be considering as pest management professionals, as other arthropod predators such as spiders and ants have been documented to feed on Ixodes scapularis nymphs and provide biological control. Previous studies have documented that the presence of ants can negatively affect tick abundance, but the underlying mechanisms of how weren't clear. So how do ticks, quote unquote, crack the code when it comes to avoiding potential predators? This study sought to understand some of the mechanisms concerning predator avoidance behavior in ticks, specifically looking at how Ixodes scapularis responded to the semiochemicals, or the communication signals, that Formica aureus, or thatching ants, produced. To test tick avoidance of ant semiochemicals, the ticks were offered a choice test between two chambers that were lined with filter paper. One chamber featured 20 ants that were permitted to walk around the chamber for 16 hours, while the other chamber was the control that only featured filter paper without any arthropod exposure. The ticks were allowed 20 hours to respond to the choice test being offered to them, and their final location was noted. Most ticks who responded to the choice test exhibited avoidance behavior of the filter paper that had been previously touched by Formica aureus workers. The researchers then looked at which chemicals may be causing the avoidance behavior by dissecting the poison gland and the Dufour's gland of the Formica aureus workers. Both glands are found in the abdomen of the ant and are important for secretion of semiochemicals, meaning that they're essential organs for ant communication. As previous studies had shown, the semiochemicals produced from the poison gland and the Dufour's gland were different, with the poison gland producing formic acid and the Dufour's gland producing hydrocarbons. Ticks were offered choice tests of semiochemicals isolated from the poison gland alone, the Dufour's gland alone, and both glands combined. Ticks did not exhibit any avoidance behaviors with the semiochemicals derived from the poison gland alone or the Dufour's gland alone, but did show avoidance behavior to the chemicals when they were combined. The researchers duplicated this experiment using synthetic compounds derived from the poison gland, which again was the formic acid, and the Dufour's gland, which was the hydrocarbons. Once again, the formic acid and the hydrocarbons by themselves did not elicit a response from the ticks, but the formic acid and the hydrocarbons combined led to the ticks avoiding that filter paper. Lastly, the researchers also examined what kind of response the ants would have to these derived semen chemicals. Ants were presented with two options: a piece of filter paper that had been soaked in the synthesized semen chemicals, or a piece of filter paper that had been soaked in dichloromethane as a control. In the choice test with Formica aureus workers, the workers were more likely to interact with the filter paper with the synthesized semen chemicals. These synthesized chemicals elicited an alarm recruitment response from the worker ants, which called even more ants to the same area. So it makes sense that ticks would want to steer clear of an area with more ants potentially coming to it. This study documented that ticks have a clear avoidance response to ant semen chemicals. By paying attention to and spying on ant semen chemicals like formic acid and ant hydrocarbons, the ticks can potentially avoid predation by ants and, like James Bond, live to die another day. Additionally, formic acid and hydrocarbons are extremely common communication signals to many ant species, which suggests that Ixodes scapularis may be spying on not just this species of ant, but many different species. Excitingly, this study presents potential for a new generation of tick repellents that could easily be synthesized from ant semen chemicals. And overall, what I think this study mostly proves is that we need to dedicate a little bit more attention to the antics of ants and ticks to determine new repellent strategies for tick management. All right, 440. I did it. I'm lowering.
Need to throw the hi-hat in there too.
Yeah. You know me, I can't get through anything like this without a dad joke or two. So
those are my favorite.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I thought this paper was super cool because, you know, I think a lot of us never really think about like the ecology and the behavior of a lot of the pests that we're interacting with. And, you know, maybe there's something there that we can kind of unlock or kind of use a little nature cheat code, as I like to call it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with that. I don't think we do. And I mean, the possibilities that exist from something like this is, I mean, unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, so I do have a question. So, and you might have said this in there, were there a specific species of ants or type of ants that they said?
Yeah, so they specifically used Formica aureus, but what I thought was super interesting about this, these researchers were in British Columbia, and what they basically did was take these Ixodes scapularis from Oklahoma that have been collected in Oklahoma, and then the Formica aureus are from British Columbia. So they're actually using them, these two species, from completely separate different locales. So It really emphasizes like how much these ticks are paying attention to these ant signals, even though that, you know, that in theory they've never interacted before, but clearly it shows that the ticks are like, oh man, there's an ant around. I got to clear out of town, get out of Dodge.
Right. Wow. That's interesting. Yeah. And that's kind of where I was going with it, is the species of ants and the location and the location of the ticks, if it weren't made a difference, but that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And formic acid and hydrocarbons, I mean, Mike can probably speak more to this than I can because he's the ant guy, but they're very common in all ant species. So that's basically their bread and butter. So the fact that the ticks were like, oh man, you know, and then what's also really cool too, this paper pointed out that I didn't really have time to throw into the description, but was the fact that, you know, formic acid is already approved by the FDA in small doses because it's used in a lot of cosmetics. So it would make it maybe a little bit easier for a tick repellent, you know, maybe through clothing or a topical application, that it might be able to kind of go through that process a little bit faster because it's already been approved for use. Right. So.
Right. Yeah, that's good. Good job. That was good. Yeah.
Thank you. All right.
That was really interesting. I actually have another question. And I'm not sure if I was understanding this correctly, but when you're talking about the ticks avoiding the semiochemicals, I think for one of the experiments you mentioned that they were synthesized, were these like lab synthesized versions or were these mm-hmm. just, okay, so these weren't just directly extracted from the ants. They actually were able to come up with it and it still counted even though it was lab mm-hmm. synthesized.
Yeah, so they did both in this paper. So they did full on extractions and then they took those extractions and then made synthesized versions of it. And then both the ants and the ticks reacted the same exact way. So pretty cool that we wouldn't have to, you know, like delicately extract ant semiochemicals. We could just synthesize them pretty quickly.
New job, just squeeze ants all day.
Yeah.
ant juicer. Handful. Oh yeah. Yeah. A handful of movie quotes come to mind here, but we're a G-rated show, so I'm not gonna quote any of the movies. Was it with
that was pretty good though.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Thank you. Thank Very you. Cool. Yeah, I thought this paper was super cool. So all right. If we're all done with questions, I think Mike, you are up next.
Okay. Yeah. King, any other questions for Laura?
No. Okay. No other questions.
All right. We'll go ahead and move on to get my timer ready here. So this is going to be a pretty straightforward summary here. So this paper, actually, I'm covering this paper in reference to the most recent episode that we did. I casually mentioned this, reading this and during the discussion. And I don't even know if it made the final episode, but I was a little bit nervous that people would hear it and think, well, maybe I should just go try this and it'll be fine. So I figured it probably would warrant about 5 minutes of discussion. So I'm going to cover the paper. It is published in the Malaria Journal, has 9 different authors. So we're just going to summarize them as Carson et al., but a lot of insanely smart folks did some really cool stuff. And the title of the research paper is Overcoming Insecticide Resistance in Anopheles Mosquitoes by Using Faster Acting Solid Forms of Deltamethrin. All right. So given their public health impacts, controlling deadly mosquitoes is critical, particularly those species that spread malaria, which is responsible for killing about 500,000 people each year around the globe. But given their high reproductive capacity, mosquitoes are quick to develop resistance to many commonly used insecticides. This is particularly true for pyrethroids, which tend to be a commonly used class of insecticide when controlling these deadly bloodsuckers. However, one group of researchers may have found an interesting way to revive a commonly used active ingredient that malaria-transmitting mosquitoes are known to have developed established resistance to. Deltamethrin is a widely used pyrethroid to control many dangerous mosquito species, including Anopheles quadrimaculatus, which is a common malaria vector here in the United States. Due to the long-term use of deltamethrin, resistance among many mosquito species is well documented. Now, trying to develop new active ingredients to overcome this resistance issue can be incredibly expensive and time-consuming. So rather than try to reinvent the chemistry wheel, researchers will often investigate ways to enhance the effectiveness of an existing active ingredient, which is exactly what Jessica Carson and colleagues were able to do in this study. Now, their study was actually the continuation of some earlier work that was published back in 2020 by one of the authors on the paper, Bart Carr, and it's worth mentioning here first. Now, in Carr's previous study, he and colleagues determined that heating deltamethrin in an oven changed its crystalline structure enough to increase both the knockdown time and the potency of this insecticide by a factor of up to 12 when compared to using the original unheated form. Now, an important note here was that the researchers in this study used susceptible mosquitoes. And when we say susceptible mosquitoes, we mean mosquitoes that have not already developed resistance to that insecticide. So we know that they're very sensitive to it. So they used susceptible mosquitoes in that study. Now, in the continuation of the work with Jessica Carson, Carr also teamed up with Carson on this current study that I'm going to summarize now, and that they just published in 2023. On determining how heating deltamethrin would impact the effectiveness of insecticide when using deltamethrin-resistant mosquitoes. So beforehand, it was non-resistant susceptible mosquitoes. Now they're testing that same theory on resistant mosquitoes. And in this study, they used a commercially available version, a powder formulation of deltamethrin. And because entomologists are wild and crazy folks, they decided that they would literally, instead of just using an oven, they would throw the stuff in a microwave for 5 minutes and see how that worked. as an alternative to heating it in the oven. And they turns out the microwave worked just fine. The researchers ultimately exposed the heated deltamethrin to five different strains of resistant Anopheles mosquitoes. So five different colony groups of mosquitoes that have been colonized and reared in a lab that were known to be resistant to these mosquitoes or captured in the wild known to be resistant, and found that the heated insecticide killed all of the resistant mosquitoes. Within about 24 hours, they had 100% knockdown. Now, on the one hand, these results are incredibly exciting. This could potentially pave the way for an incredibly easy to use, very accessible technique to potentially enhance the effectiveness of deltamethrin, maybe even other insecticides. They haven't looked at anything else yet. And not only on its effectiveness towards these resistant mosquitoes, but maybe even other resistant populations, like bed bugs are a great example of a pest group that is also resistant to many pyrethroids. But, and this is why I'm covering it here, there's a handful of caveats and disclaimers that we need to cover really quick, some by the authors and some by me as the guy that's talking about this on a podcast. First, the researchers used a controlled laboratory environment to microwave the insecticides. This wasn't like their buddy's dorm room microwave down the hall that somebody had just used to heat up a burrito, right? This is a dedicated machine for this purpose alone. They followed a handful of other safety protocols when they conducted the study. Basically, don't go thinking you could just take the stuff off your truck, zap it in the microwave for 5 minutes and fix the next like problem account, right? That's not how this really works, even though it kind of sounds like that. Another consideration here is that many current commercial uses for deltamethrin to control mosquitoes, such as cotton bed netting, may not lend very well to just simply being heated as they currently sit, because things like cotton tend to like to burst into flames when subjected to high heat. Though the researchers did suggest some methods of application that could work as some potential workarounds, considerations, and things that may be promising for the near future, and they're trying to work on those solutions now. But at any rate, this is an exciting discovery and will seemingly lead to new important developments on the fight against insecticide-resistant mosquitoes and perhaps other pests as well in the near future. 459.
Cool. I was like, did he go over?
No.
What a professional. What a professional.
Yeah, it's wow. They're high price to pay if you don't go over. Now, I will tell you, King, before you give me any tough questions, I'm an entomologist, not a chemist, and I did do my homework to try to figure out what exactly was going on with this stuff. And I got to one sentence in particular in the paper and thought, this isn't worth it. I'm not gaining anything from this. And if anybody has questions, we'll find somebody else smarter to connect them to. So I tried to read the description of what exactly was happening with the changes in the crystalline structure. And I'm gonna read one sentence for you guys. This doesn't count towards my time. The relationship between the lethality of crystalline contact insecticide and its crystalline structure ultimately arises in thermochemistry. I've not taken any thermochemistry before, so I'm already out of my depth. Weak intermolecular interactions and associated shallow potential energy hyperfaces readily lead to solid crystalline forms or polymorphs with different molecular organizations in the solid state accompanied by distinct chemical and physical properties, including crystal-free energies. So if you have any questions about what happened to this stuff in the microwave, I'm just going to read that to you over and over and over again until you give up and we don't have to answer anymore. If you have any other questions, I could try to answer them. But
it's crazy. That was my first question. I was going to ask what happened to this
stuff. It changed the crystalline structure, and that's all I'm at liberty to say.
Fair. You know, I'm just impressed that they thought about just throwing it in a microwave and seeing, you know, what... Well, what do you get?
This is one of those things that, like, once you read one article or publication, then you kind of go back, and that's what led me to like the 2020 study, and then I started kind of going back a little bit more, and it turns out, like, to no surprise, this wasn't the first time somebody's heated up a product,
right?
And I guess heating up something that does have a crystalline structure does fundamentally alter that structure, or can alter that structure. A lot of the earlier studies were done looking at DET because that was one of the first most well-known established resistance problems that we really had widespread. So some of that was born from trying to figure out ways to improve the effectiveness of DET. But yeah, so last time I said, yeah, just throw stuff in the microwave. And I was like, probably shouldn't be making that recommendation. So let me follow that up with this disclaimer that there was a study that was done. And they didn't, well, they did just literally throw it in the microwave. And the researchers are quoted as saying, we thought it'd be fun to throw it in the microwave and see what happens. We are not condoning, nor are we endorsing the idea that you put anything in the microwave. As you could hear by this sentence that I read earlier, there's some really complicated stuff going on associated with thermochemistry that I'm not qualified to address, but that I don't think that's going to be the case for everything. So.
Is there a lawyer in that closet behind you, Mike?
I'll have a disclaimer that everyone's going to have to acknowledge before they listen to this episode, I'm sure.
No, you know, that was really good, Mike. I thought it was interesting. I was a little intrigued about the process of, throwing it in the microwave and heating it up. And I had to laugh because, you were saying, well, although it sounds like you can throw it in a microwave like your friend's microwave down the street, throw a burrito in it. I'm like, because I could picture someone saying, yeah, let's just throw this in the microwave and see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, they reference the product they use in here. It's a over-the-counter, commercially available dust. It's a dust formulation of that product. And they used a very scientific approach for the oven. They used an exact temperature and to everything else. But this was, let's just see what happens with a lot of unknowns. If you're talking mosquito control in parts of the world that are impacted most heavily by malaria, you're talking about areas that are not going to have sophisticated equipment to be able to do this. A microwave is a pretty easy thing to get a hold of.
I just had a vision of people with easy bake ovens in the back of their trucks or something.
Yeah.
Like running the Delta Methrin through it. Like,
oh man. Yeah. We're not condoning that, everybody. If we're not saying this is a solution, do not go do this. Do not go do this. Leave it to the scientists that are microwaving their own stuff in their own microwave.
So yeah, no, it was good research. I thought it was a very traditional approach, like what you said. I'm sure this has been done before. This is not the first time to an issue that we've have had for quite some time, and to realize how effective it could be, and the potential for use. I mean, it's great, and then the resistance. I mean, that's something that we, like you said, bed bugs, a great example.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was the big home runs for this were, one, they used a really unpredictable heating method that is very easy to access in pretty much anywhere in the world. And the other thing was using resistant populations and testing this theory against them and seeing that it was still effective against resistant populations was probably the biggest home run. So,
that was good. Yeah.
Awesome. All right, Ellie.
All right. So
you got this.
All right. Well, so the paper that I found, it took a little bit of a creative risk here. It's a little different than what we usually have. So was published in Annual Reviews of Entomology. So this is kind of a big review, and it was published finally in January of this year. So just a couple months ago. And this was done by Michael Rust, Chow Yang Lee, Gary Bennett, and William Robinson. So it's called The Emergence and Sustainability of Urban Entomology. So this article goes through the history of urban entomology publications and brings us to the current state of today and the whole industry. So the term urban entomology was first used in 1884 in a note by A.H. Waters, and skipped to a century later, and it finally actually gets used more regularly, starting with a book called Urban Entomology, published in 1975 by W. Ebling. So this began the common usage of the term in subsequent studies and publications. Now, urban entomology developed as a response to urbanization. It's a field of study that came about relatively recently, and it's expanded along with humans as we've spread across the world. And although the term urban entomology wasn't official till the 70s, we still have some very notable books published before that, including Malus's Handbook of Pest Control in 1945, which they had editions of up until very recently, and then The Scientific Guide to Pest Control Operations in 1962. And the paper moves on to talk about some factors contributing to the importance of urban entomology, starting with urbanization. So we mentioned that it's grown along with humanity, and we've shifted from mostly rural living to urban living, living in cities. And this shift has created huge opportunities for pests to thrive, including the emergence of new pests as their natural habitats get built over. An interesting point that they mentioned is that with urbanization, there's an increase in disgust with insects indoors, and what may have been ignored in rural areas is actually considered more of a pest, and more people will call for controlled measures in urban areas. There's also invasive pests that have been a huge factor, with new pests emerging in areas where they would have never got to without the global infrastructure of the world today. More trade creates more pests and requires more study and exchange of information in the field of urban entomology. Similarly, resurgence of known pests, especially with insecticide resistance, demands further research and expansion of the field. A classic example is bed bugs, resurgence of a pest, and now we've got a lot more research to do about it. And now the paper kind of shifts into who is involved. So the structural pest control and professional pest management industry began in the United States back in the 1930s and has grown over the last about 100 years to surpass $11 billion worth in 2022. That is a huge number, and it proves how widespread the pest management industry really is. With FIFRA, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act back in 1947 and amended in 1972, that's what brought us to the requirements of licensing, training, and re-education that we're familiar with today. So with these requirements, land-grant universities increased cooperative extension services, creating endowed positions in universities, creating space for urban entomologists in higher education. Nowadays, these positions and those cooperative extension programs are being reduced when retirees don't end up getting replaced. There's also organizations and societies that have held educational conferences, including and elevating urban entomology as a field. Things like the Entomological Society of America, the National Conference on Urban Entomology, and Pi Chi Omega, and plenty more, created space for urban entomologists to share information and innovate in the field. A lot of that ended up being geared towards academia, and so then we also have conferences aimed towards the pest management professionals. Back in the 1930s, we had the Purdue Annual Conference and the National Pest Management Association, which at the time was the National Pest Control Association. And up until today, we've got our big conferences like Pest World. But as rules and regulations regarding use of products and licensing increased, so did these educational conferences. And that kind of brings us to today and like where we're looking towards in the future. So research and education, which is what we need, is expensive. Funding is required to continue innovations and discoveries to improve the industry. The paper talks about how the cooperation between the pest management industry and land-grant universities is really what brought us to where we are today, and that cooperation is key. As some entomology departments are merging and professors are retiring, we need more research, not less, as we face resistance, environmental protection, climate change, globalization, and all of that. So to summarize, we've come pretty far. We've got far to go. And the field of urban entomology needs our support now more than ever. So a couple seconds over there, I actually had to cut off a little bit of myself. I just got all excited and I wrote too much.
That's cool. That's a cool publication.
Yeah, that is. I mean, it's interesting, the difference between providing pest control services in an urban area and a rural area. And here in Connecticut, I mean, I have seven technicians, and I'll have one technician in a particular city, and the skills and experience and the knowledge needed for that technician is completely different. And to be honest with you, it's more complex than our technicians who are in the rural areas of Connecticut. The pests are different. I mean, everything. It's completely, completely different. But that was pretty good. Thank you, Ellie.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it was really an interesting kind of thing to see. Like I said, I felt like I was taking a little bit of creative risk here, looking at a kind of review and overview, but it's been a while since we've had something like that on the podcast. But I feel like that also gets our listeners to kind of have a little bit of history as to how we ended up where we are.
I agree. I mean, it's good to hear the history. I think it's definitely, well, relevant now, especially in Connecticut. You know, we're facing some legislative bills that are, you know, faced toward restricting rodenticide use. And the whole purpose of that is, you know, for the birds or raptors, which are in rural areas, and they don't want to use rodenticides at all, which is not feasible. And it's going to really impact more or less the inner city or urban areas. And that's not where your birds or raptors are located. So I think something like that is informative, not only just for our industry and service technicians, but also for, you know, the opposition who's proposing the bills, and also for the legislators to understand, you know, that there is a complete difference between urban pest control and urban entomology and rural pest control. So that was good.
Thank you.
So I don't
That's the
really
fun
have any.
part, buddy.
Yeah. I know this is a tough part.
Yeah.
I also want to make a little side mention that I don't know if it sounded a little bit too doom and gloom about the future of things, but I wanted to say something that's really cool is that we have the Pest Management Foundation that funds urban entomology research. So talking about how great it is to have new research and how much we want to support that, NPMA and the Pest Management Foundation is working to turn that around and to fund the future generation of urban entomologists. So there's hope. There's hope. We're doing stuff. We've got good things going too.
Well said. Lots of good support from a lot of different angles. And if anybody's interested in learning more about what Ellie's talking about, we can ensure to add a link in our podcast episode description too. So.
Yeah, absolutely. That work is important. It's needed. You know, it's and like I said, you know, we are all facing legislative bills against rodenticides, and I mean, this is something that is definitely resonates with what's going on in the public policy climate right now. So, and it's good to know a little bit about the past, and you know, hopefully we get more people to invest in that. And like I said, I mean, it's good to hear. This is tough.
Stop.
Just gotta take the band-aid off, buddy.
This is tough. Yeah, this is tough. I gotta say, Ellie, I appreciated you taking that risk. I
Yeah,
thought,
thank you.
you know, I thought it was good to hear that and hear something different and hear a little bit about the history. And you know, this is tough. I gotta say though, you know, I think Laura did a good job. You know, I got being in the state of Connecticut and Lyme disease, you know, being that the epicenter, I thought that the research with the ants and you know, the potential to help control ticks and repel ticks is really interesting. And it's, you know, my daughter. So this also resonates with me because one of my daughters was bit by a tick and has Lyme disease. And
Wow.
so, you know, I've been in pest control for so long. And I will say, you know, we in pest control, we typically didn't treat for ticks, and we typically didn't treat for wildlife, and we didn't treat for mosquitoes. So to see the evolution of where we are now is amazing. And so I didn't know a lot about ticks at that point, and I did some more research and learned a lot, but I was amazed to find the lack of research about Lyme disease And, you know, so it's good to see something like this. I think it'll lead to a lot of other potential for control measures. But I thought that was interesting. I think Laura did a great job, and I like that research.
Right.
Thank you.
Good job, Laura.
That was a really cool paper.
I didn't do the research, but thank you.
You take the gold crown for I had hater blockers prepared just in case, because I'm not in the office today. Yeah, but
okay.
This was good. This
why,
is going to be the crown.
Why do you suddenly look like Macho Man Randy Savage?
That's right. But this works perfectly to deflect the bad vibes here. So
just blocking out haters. Yeah,
that's right.
The cream always rises to the top.
So King, this is Laura's back to back on this back to back champ.
So, I'm awesome. Angling for the triple crown next time.
You notice, though, Laura, there was no dirty fighting here where somebody starts off by saying who the winner was last time to potentially sway the judges,
okay,
like you
did,
so
though,
often
of...
like to do.
I almost said
we did, though, because the person who won always goes first.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but you seriously look like Macho Man Randy Savage when you put those on, and I really can't handle it.
You're like, I've never taken you seriously before, but I really can't take you seriously now. Oh man, that's awesome. Well, congrats, yeah. Laura. It's so funny. Every time we do these, I pick a paper that I really like, and then I listen to your guys's, and mine's never, I mean, I always love the research I'm reading about, but it's never like my favorite on the show. Like, honestly, Ellie, that the annual, I mean, I love those kinds of things. It is really cool. And you mentioned, you know, the 1930s, kind of the start of pest control. That's when MPMA at the time, MPCA, got its start. And we've got some really cool, you know, we're lucky to have some members that are part of that origination of structural pest control there. So that was really cool. And you know, obviously, Laura, just, it's hard to beat ticks. I'm telling you, it's a good one. And anything with ants is always going to be top.
I know.
Top paper
I used your favorites against you this week.
Double whammy, a double pest.
I know.
Also, I'm just saying, every time I do a tick paper, I win. So I might just keep doing tick papers.
Well, Ellie, just know that the next time we do this, just make sure you inform the judge that Laura has won twice in a row.
Yes.
And pause for a second for dramatic effect.
Just
so
wait.
Really sinks in
the silence. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
guarantee
you,
that seal of
it.
Death.
So, you know, I gotta say, I didn't know who won the last time. I had no clue, but I did know, as I said before, I listened to the show, so I did know whoever went first typically, you know, won. So
okay, yeah, so he knew.
So I kind of had an idea, but but yeah, you know.
we'll test that theory next time. I'm just kidding. You did awesome, Laura. That was great.
Thanks. Yeah, no, it was a super cool paper, so I had to give it its due. So,
well, King, we really appreciate it, buddy. Thanks so much, man, for coming on. Even though you knew what you were getting into with this, you still agreed to do it, which I think makes me really appreciate you accepting the invitation even more. So,
it's a pleasure, you know. Like I said, it's like, you know, being invited to the party. I'm glad I'm here.
It's very exclusive.
yeah, very exclusive. Oh yeah. Well, like I said before, buddy, you being here is what makes it a party. So we really appreciate it, man. So
yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, everybody. Well, that's gonna do it for another episode of MPMA's Bug Bites.
If you're interested in hearing more about any of the research we cover on the podcast, be sure to check out our Pestology blog. You can find the blog at npmapestology.com, and we'll also have a link in the description of this podcast.
And be sure to like and rate the podcast, leave feedback if you have any, and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss the release of a new episode. Thanks for listening.
MPMA Bug Bites is the industry's source for the latest in science news and pest control research. It's brought to you by the National Pest Management Association. You can find links to the science discussed in this episode, as well as technical and business resources, training opportunities, and information about careers in pest control by visiting npmatraining.com. www.freedomfromhate.org.